He's strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Dan Friedel, and Anna Mateo. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam announced Monday that she will not seek a new term in office. The decision comes as Lam prepares to end her current 5-year term, during which she faced major anti-government protests and the COVID-19 pandemic. The territory's next leader is expected to be chosen in May. The position is elected by a committee of lawmakers, industry members, and legislative representatives loyal to the government in Beijing. Hong Kong media have reported that Lam's chief secretary, John Lee, is likely to enter the race to succeed her. Lee started his career as a police officer and rose to become the deputy chief of police in 2010. He served as Hong Kong's secretary of security during anti-government protests in 2019. The election for the chief executive had been set for March 27th, but it was postponed until May 8th as the city deals with a new rise in COVID-19 infections. At a news conference, the 64-year-old Lam said, "I will complete my 5-year term as chief executive on the 30th of June this year, and I will also call an end to my 42 years of public service." She added that her main reason for deciding not to run again was her family. "I have told everyone before that family is my first priority. They think it's time for me to go home." Lam was born in British-ruled Hong Kong in 1957. She is a lifelong government worker who describes herself as an active Catholic. She took office in 2017 with a promise to unite the city. People in Hong Kong were growing increasingly concerned with moves by the government in Beijing to strengthen its political control over the territory. 2 years later, millions of democracy supporters took to the streets of Hong Kong in sometimes violent anti-government protests. The unrest led to China approving a national security law in 2020. The law calls for offenses like subversion and secession to be punished with sentences up to life in prison. Critics of the law say it seeks to silence dissent and crush freedoms promised to Hong Kong when it passed to Chinese control in 1997. Rights of the territory's citizens were to be guaranteed under its basic law for 50 years. Supporters of the national security law say it has brought stability to Hong Kong. In 2020, the United States placed sanctions on Lam, Lee, and other Hong Kong officials for supporting the national security law. Lam was also heavily criticized for supporting a proposed extradition bill supported by China's government. That legislation, which was later withdrawn, would have permitted criminal suspects to be sent to mainland China for trial. I'm Brian Lin.
Tattoo artists in South Korea will continue to risk arrest if they violate a long-standing ban on their work. Last week, the highest court in the country ruled in support of the restriction. Only medical professionals may legally tattoo people in South Korea. A tattoo is a permanent image on skin. Tattoo artists use needles filled with ink to mark the body with words or a design. Some people consider the practice an important form of expression. The Constitutional Court voted 5-4 last week to keep the law in place. It said the tattooing is a medical process that carries risks. Tattoo artists do not have the training to provide acceptable medical care to the people, the court said. Violators of the law risk serious punishment, including fines of about $40,000 and 2 years in prison. Tattoo artist groups in South Korea began pushing for reform of the law in 2017. The ban is based on one that Japan established in 1992. However, that country has since repealed the law. Kim Do-yoon leads an alliance of about 650 tattoo artists seeking reform. The group condemned the court's decision as a rejection of modern time. The court is still walking on 4 feet when all citizens walk upright, Kim said. The popular tattooist is better known as Doi. Tattoos in South Korea are becoming more popular. While they are rarely seen on television, some South Korean celebrities, including actors and musicians, show their tattoos on social media. Public opinion research in South Korea finds that most people support an end to the tattoo art restrictions. Tattooists and their supporters say the law is too strong. Kim Seo-yoon is the president of the Korea Tattoo Federation. She called the court's decision nonsense. She spoke to reporters gathered at the courthouse in Seoul. She wondered why the court still considered tattooing a medical treatment when, in her words, doctors can't and don't do that. Even South Korea's president-elect, Yoon Suk-yeol, said he supported permitting tattoos that can be used to make hair seem darker. I'm Dan Friedel.
From VOA Learning English, This is the Health and Lifestyle Report. If you want your children to become ready, willing, and able gardeners, take steps early. It is not difficult, but you might need to change your thinking about children in the garden. That is one of the many suggestions made by Jeff Lowenfels. He writes about gardening for the Associated Press. Lowenfels says that gardeners are made, not born. He suggests several ways to help turn a child into a gardener. The first step is to get your child interested in plants. This, he says, is getting more difficult because of competition from electronics. Taking a child to a plant store is another good place to start. There they can smell the flowers and touch other plants. Next, let your child buy a plant. Lowenfels says he still remembers the first plant his father helped him choose when he was 6 years old. He says that plant, called a lantana, is where his love of plants and gardening began to grow. Children, not old enough to care for a plant by themselves, need adults to teach them. This may be the best way to get children interested in gardening. Children copy adults. So let them see how much you enjoy working with plants. Another great way to lead young people into gardening is to have them grow plants from seeds. This is very effective when the plants are things they like to eat. Carrots are favorites of many children. Lowenfels suggests starting with larger seeds. Handling very small seeds may frustrate small children. He says there are plenty of seeds big enough for little fingers to pick up and plant. He suggests marigolds, cosmos, zinnias, sunflowers, corn, peas, and beans. They are all also easy to start in containers, as well as directly into the garden's soil. Don't forget that children like responsibility. Find a gardening task that fits their age and is just for them. They can fill containers with soil. You can show them how to water and how to place labels. You can also show them how to provide the right amount of light. Small children can help in other ways. Lowenfels says his first garden job at age 5 was deadheading dandelion flowers into a container. To deadhead means to take dead flowers off a plant. When his own children wanted to be in the garden, he gave them the job of hunting worms. Then they moved on to deadheading dandelions and pulling weeds. Most important, however, is to have the proper attitude as head gardener and teacher. Any adult teaching a child about gardening, he says, needs an easygoing, go-with-the-flow attitude. If not, they could put a child off gardening forever. Learning is about making mistakes. And with gardening, that means stepping on plants and accidentally pulling things that are not weeds. Lowenfels shares a story of his own daughter. At the time, she was 4 years old and was helping him prepare their flower garden for a flower show the next day. Unbeknownst to Lowenfels, she was following behind him and cleaning up, which to her meant removing all the flowers. Instead of getting angry, he simply put the flowers into containers and set them near the bare plants. Because of a little attitude adjustment on my part, he writes, 40 years later, my daughter still loves to garden. And she is pretty good at floral arranging too. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember.
Three days from now, after half a century in the service of our country, I shall lay down the responsibilities of office as, in traditional and solemn ceremony, the authority of the presidency is vested in my successor. This evening, I come to you with a message of leave-taking and farewell, and to share a few final thoughts with you, my countrymen.
Dwight Eisenhower was elected president in 1952. The following year, the Korean War ended with an armistice, a ceasefire agreement. During his presidency, Eisenhower began a tradition of meetings between the leaders of the United States and the Soviet Union. He met with Soviet leaders Nikolai Bulganin and Nikita Khrushchev. These meetings may have helped reduce the threat of a nuclear war between the two countries during the Cold War. By 1960, Eisenhower had served two terms. The Constitution was changed to prevent presidents from being elected more than twice after Franklin Roosevelt won four times.
We now stand 10 years past the midpoint of a century that has witnessed four major wars among great nations. Three of these involved our own country. Despite these holocausts, America is today the strongest, the most influential, and most productive nation in the world. Understandably proud of this preeminence, we yet realize that America's leadership and prestige depend not merely upon our unmatched material progress, riches, and military strength, but on how we use our power in the interests of world peace and human betterment. Throughout America's corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
At the end of Eisenhower's first term, he was still very popular. He had suffered a heart attack, but the Republican president felt strong enough to campaign again in 1956. His Democratic Party opponent was Adlai Stevenson. They had been the candidates in the presidential election 4 years earlier. This time, Eisenhower won almost 10 million more votes than Stevenson, an even bigger victory than in 1952. Eisenhower's second term, however, presented problems. The Soviet Union launched the space age by putting the first satellite into orbit around Earth. Fidel Castro established a communist government in Cuba. Many white Americans were fighting the Supreme Court's decision to end racial separation in schools. And the American economy suffered a recession. Eisenhower's popularity dropped during his second term. This would make it difficult for the Republican Party's next candidate for president. The delegates who attended the presidential nominating convention in the summer of 1960 feared that their party would lose the election in November. They had to find the strongest candidate possible. Many believed that Richard Nixon was the strongest. Nixon had been a senator and a member of the House of Representatives. He had been Eisenhower's vice president for 8 years. When Eisenhower suffered several serious illnesses, Nixon had a chance to show his abilities to lead the nation. He showed great strength while facing an angry crowd during a trip to South America. He also gained support when he defended the United States to Khrushchev during a trip to the Soviet Union. Nixon's closest opponent for the Republican nomination was Nelson Rockefeller. Rockefeller was the governor of New York State. He came from one of the richest families in America. Richard Nixon easily won the support of the party. The delegates nominated him on the first vote. He accepted the nomination, and he called for new efforts for peace and freedom around the world. The race for the Democratic nomination was much more difficult. The Democratic Party thought it would have no problem winning the presidential election. Many candidates entered the race for the nomination. One was Senator Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota. Another was Senator John Kennedy of Massachusetts. Humphrey had been elected to the Senate 3 times. He was a strong activist for civil rights and peace. Kennedy was a Navy hero in World War II. He was handsome and only 43 years old. He was also Roman Catholic. No Catholic had ever been elected president of the United States. Kennedy and Humphrey began to compete in state primary elections, the first step in the nominating process. Kennedy won an important primary in Wisconsin. But voters in Protestant areas of that state did not support him. The question then became, could he win in another state, West Virginia? Most of the voters in that state were Protestant. On the last night of the primary campaign in West Virginia, Kennedy spoke about his religion. He said, "The President of the United States promises to defend the Constitution. And that," he said, "includes the separation of the government from any religion or church." Kennedy won a big victory in West Virginia. He then went on to win many votes in other primaries. He received the nomination on the first vote at the Democratic Convention. In his acceptance speech, he said he would ask Americans to help their country and sacrifice for their country. After the party conventions, the two candidates, Kennedy and Nixon, began to campaign around the country. Nixon charged that Kennedy was too young to be president. He said Kennedy did not know enough about governing. Kennedy attacked the Republican record of the past 8 years. He said President Eisenhower and Vice President Nixon had not done enough to bring progress to the nation. Protestant groups expressed concerns about Kennedy's religion. They wondered if he would be influenced by the Pope. They wondered if the leader of the Roman Catholic Church would try to make policy for the United States. Kennedy answered by repeating his strong support for the constitutional separation of church and state. Public opinion surveys showed the election campaign to be very close. Then the candidates agreed to hold four debates on television. In the first debate, the candidates showed they did not differ too widely on major issues. Kennedy appeared calm and sure, but Nixon did not feel well. He appeared thin and tired. Many people who had not considered voting for Kennedy now began to change their minds. To them, he looked more presidential. Most people seemed to feel that Kennedy won the first debate. Nixon probably won the second one. And both men did about the same in the last two. In the fourth debate, they expressed widely different opinions about whether the United States was making progress. Kennedy believed there had been little progress under Eisenhower and Nixon.
Franklin Roosevelt said in 1936 that that generation of Americans had a rendezvous with destiny. I believe in 1960 and 61 and 2 and 3, we have a rendezvous with destiny. And I believe it incumbent upon us to be the defenders of the United States and the defenders of freedom. And to do that, we must give this country leadership, and we must get America moving again.
Nixon disagreed. He believed the United States had not been standing still, but there was more to be done.
It is essential, with the conflict that we have around the world, that we not just hold our own, that we not keep just freedom for ourselves. It is essential that we extend freedom, extend it to all the world. And this means more than what we've been doing. It means keeping America even stronger militarily than she is. It means seeing that our economy moves forward even faster than it has. It means making more progress in civil rights than we have, so that we can be a splendid example for all the world to see.
Another issue in the 1960 presidential debates was the Chinese attack on the islands of Quemoy and Matsu in the Taiwan Strait. And another was how to deal with Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. After the debates, the presidential candidates campaigned around the country again. Nixon proposed that if he were elected, he would travel to Eastern Europe and meet with Khrushchev. Kennedy proposed the Peace Corps, a program to send Americans to developing countries to provide technical aid and other help. On Election Day in November, the voters chose John Kennedy as their 35th president. His victory, however, was a close one. Almost 69 million people voted. Kennedy won by fewer than 120,000 votes.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.